ओमिज्ञानतिमरन्दस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. वंशकौपातरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेभ्य च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द स्याद्वैता गदाधार श्रीवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द. हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे रामो हरे रामो राम राम हरे हरे. So greetings from the Sun Falls at Stuyvesant Falls, New York, where I stay. And the next class that I will give will be from Moscow, but the timings are such that it won't be any difficult. I believe it'll be sometime in the afternoon there, like 3 o'clock, and then it'll be the time behind here would be about 8 o'clock at night. Just mentioning before I begin, this is something new that we're trying, just to discuss different points, and I'm trying to get the grasp of it. This type of medium, where you don't see the audience, it's not always easy, although somehow I've been doing it for 3.5 years. But the process I've been doing it previously is I've been reading a text so I could fully put myself into the text. And then when the subject is finished, then I can go to another text. And that way I can go for quite a long time. This way I'm just kind of speaking in a summary form. I'm not sure this format will work, but I'm willing to give it a try and or adjust it appropriately so it does work. I do want more discussion. I did get some questions by mail, which were nice, which I could discuss today. So I'd like to continue the discussion that we began yesterday and discuss it a little bit further. If possible, discuss a new topic, which is that of Krishna Arjuna as the archetype for the teacher and the student. Because the first chapter is Vishad Yoga, the yoga of dejection. And in a basic term, if yoga means to a process to link or turn to the absolute, Vishad Yoga means that the circumstances in life that we are put under by destiny, and destiny is God. In the Bhagavatam, destiny or what happens to you by the force of time is considered a direct manifestation of the super soul of Paramatma, God. Paramatma means the divine interacting with this world. How the divine interacts with this world. One second, I just spilled something, excuse me. And one of the ways in which the divine interacts with this world is by giving us the fruits of our karma and arranging experiences for us. So in one sense, a devotee, one who surrenders to God, let's say a person is not under karma. Because why? Because karma or destiny is meant to purify us to come to the point of our nature as a soul, nature of a spark of love and devotion. So if we are ignited ourselves in devotion, in one sense it's counteractive, but in another sense it's not, because destiny is God's law to bring us closer to us. And to the extent, even if we are devotees, we are not purified, and we need certain experiences based on our who we are. And therefore, who we are means also what we did in the past. Then that destiny comes and gives us happiness, gives us distress, and sometimes gives us calamity and really intense adversity. And here in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna's circumstance is one of intense adversity, and adversity means what? Enjoyment means control. Because you want to enjoy, things have to go your way, and adversity is when things go out of control. And the most intense adversity is when you realize that there's no direction you can go to fix it. Which is spiritual in itself, because that is a spiritual decision, that we're actually not the controller, God is. And we have to depend on Him for God's mercy. So adversity in itself, in one sense, is a spiritual phenomenon. So anyway, we have the situation with Arjuna, where his whole life is adversity, and it culminates in a war. And he's forced to fight. And nimitani viparitani, we read that verse, where you look around and the cause seems the opposite. The cause of what? I want to be happy, so I won't fight. But the opposite is, if you don't fight, then what, you know, I want to be happy, so I don't want to do this. I don't want to fight in the war. I don't want to fight my relatives. Then what's Arjuna's situation? His family is slaughtered. He lives in servitude for the rest of his life. He lives in guilt of not protecting his family. Okay, he does fight for happiness, but the cause is the opposite. Because if he fights, then many of the people he loves are also killed. And then how can he enjoy the world? So God puts us into these circumstances. In the Bhagavad Gita, we see it's Krishna himself that drives the chariot to let Arjuna have a view of the other side, and Bhishma, Drona, Pamukkata, he puts it right in the face of the opposing army, who's led by his guru, Dronacharya, and his dear grandfather, Bhishma Dev, and these are the people he has to fight. So he has an existential dilemma. Because each choice entails, the choices you make entail the conception or you have of yourself. And as long as the conception is not of the real self, there will be distress. So even if one is enjoying and you have a conception that's not the real self, or you know, you may identify the function of the world. That's the ego, the hankara, gives you a self-conception. It's not that it's not, like I'm a sannyasi. I have to live by that conception. I have certain dealings as a monk with the opposite sex that's dictated by the conception I have and my duty. So, but when that becomes the overriding conception of the self rather than the soul, because that's also external to the self. Gender is external to the self. Your occupation is external to the self. So it's an identity crisis also, because you can't see your you can't see what your dharma is, because you don't really understand your true identity. But when this adversity, I had this realization today, when this adversity comes and when things are out of control, if one has any piety, any sense of eternality and any sense of divinity in the soul, you have to seek happiness elsewhere. Anandamaya Abhyasat, the nature of the soul is to seek happiness. Nature of the soul is to see. So you have to seek happiness elsewhere. You yourself may think of a particular situation that you face. And if there's some piety, if there's difficulty, if there's crisis, a crisis where you see no way out of a destiny that is against your desire, and you can't see any way out, if the destiny is against your desire, and not only against your desire, it's against your control. You can't do anything about it. Then one has to search for meaning elsewhere. Suffering impels us to seek cure. And when crises lack intensity, we tend to tolerate. So there's a sense of intensity that forces us to tackle the problem that is already there. And that's basically what suffering is. There's a problem there, let's say physically. There's a problem there. It's not that the heart is healthy, and then you get a heart attack, and the problem is the heart attack. No, the heart attack is indicating, is intensifying the crisis so you'll see cure. The problem was there before you got the heart attack. And therefore, there's a sense that the world is designed that those who seek happiness and illusion, or seek happiness and identification with the mind and body, they have to face crisis. Because if you're identifying with something which is not eternal, then you'll suffer because when that identity is threatened. Your real identity is never threatened. And therefore, there's a certain comfort in realizing the soul. I had that experience myself in my trial by fire. In my trial by fire, I took shelter in meditation. I took shelter in the holy name. And then I had that sense that the activity of spirituality, in terms of chanting mantras and meditating, I was doing the activity of the soul. And I realized that that identity as a loving energy that serves the divine, which is inclusive of others, that that identity is eternal. I felt a great comfort in that. And that's where fearlessness comes from. But any other identity, which even you enjoy, if you invest in that identity fully, then you'll face crisis, because that identity will go. So there's a sense, better to die while living. Better to die while living, which means to accept the temporality of that identity, the material identity, and seek the spiritual identity. Better that at some time of your life, and therefore in Indian culture, there's supposed to be a particular time of life towards the end where you can fully focus on spiritual identity. Okay, and therefore, I try to put suffering in a light, in the yoga of dejection, as a sense of incongruity with Dharma, that there is something wrong. I gave the example of Vyasadeva, where he had done so much incredible work editing the Vedas, And he was cut because he's editor. He wants to make things clear. Vyasadeva means the godly editor. So there's a concept of eternal knowledge existing, that it's not something that's created, discovered. It's something that's eternally existing with the world, which has a purpose. And it was an oral tradition. Vyasadeva, at the beginning of Kali Yuga 5,000 years ago, he has to write it down. He does this incredible job. He sees it's too vast for people to digest it. He breaks it into four different sections. Still is doubtful if people can digest it. The one Veda is that becomes the Yajur Sama Atharva and Rig Veda. He's still doubtful if people can digest it. He illustrates the message of the Veda in story form, which is the Mahabharata, which includes the Bhagavad Gita. Then he codifies the knowledge in the Vedanta Sutra. And after doing all that, in all sincerity, when he feels dissatisfaction, he becomes puzzled, because why should he feel dissatisfied if his activities are harmonious with the mood of service, which is the nature of the soul? But still, he goes deeper, and then he realizes, as I have done something wrong, I haven't sufficiently glorified God, which is a message in itself. That's the nature of the soul, is bhakti. And the main expression of bhakti, the main activity of bhakti, is to chant and hear about the object of your bhakti or devotion. But then I'm happy I got a very nice question. Someone asked, can suffering be a result of your duty? Because I said suffering suffering is a sense of disharmony. So I think the question is very nice, but we see that sometimes suffering is a result of your duty. That you're doing your duty, and your duty is difficult, and you're suffering. It's a very nice question. Can suffering be a result of doing your duty? Well, there's a certain thing called tapasya, austerity. And austerity means, despite the irrational impulses of your mind and your senses, you continue to do your duty. So in that sense, the suffering is the result of duty. It's not a result of a lack of harmony, but in the same sense it is. Because why is it an austerity? It's an austerity because one is not attached one is not attached to one's duty. In other words, you're doing something that's right, but at the same sense, there's still disharmony. There's disharmony. It's not that you should say, "Oh, I'm suffering. This is the wrong duty." But no, there's disharmony because your thoughts and mood and attachment are in disharmony with your nature or duty. So the suffering is still a result of some kind of disharmony. But it's not a result of disharmony of doing your duty. But it's still a disharmony that there's something that's not lined up. And what's not lined up, just like we chant Hare Krishna. So it may be very difficult to sit down and chant 16 rounds for some people. So they can't say, it's suffering, therefore it's not my duty. No, what suffering is that you have what's the disharmony? The disharmony is with what you are as a soul and what you like to do based on your mind. So anyway, this is the basis right now we have of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is seeking not to fight, and this crisis. It forces you, one, to seek happiness elsewhere besides the control of the environment. It also, one seeks guidance if he's pious, because it's a reorientation of one's conception. Obviously, you're thinking, this is who I am, and if I act this way, I'll be happy, but now I'm acting this way, and the world is—it's still like I'm still difficulty. So you seek guidance, and you have to reorient yourself, because material consciousness means you see everything as the object for your enjoyment, and you see yourself as the subject. And when you can't enjoy, you have to question that core material conception. Is this the way I should think? Because really, you can only become happy not when you try to enjoy, but you try to serve. Because when you try to enjoy, you may or may not fulfill your desires. They're not under your control, because you're investing in your destiny. When you try to serve, then it's not dependent on the external. It's dependent on your free will. And you can do that in any situation. I described in the previous class the Viktor Frankl. He wrote A Search for Meaning, and he was in a concentration camp. And adversity was what we can't even imagine. We wouldn't even pray for anyone to have to face a situation like that. The utter torture that people were put through. I've read the book. Basically, you can't read the page. Kind of humiliation, torture. People were constantly, basically they would work people to death. And people were sick and still had to work. They had no shoes. It was the winter. They had no clothes. They had no heat. They had no food. They were wet. It was raining. It was cold. It was just, and they were tortured. And that situation for Viktor Frankl, I mean, just completely forced him to reorient himself from happiness being the environment to happiness being my free will. Of course, the suffering was still there, but he found meaning in life, because no one can take away the free will of the soul. Okay. Mamuni, do you have any questions or anything?
Maharaj, there's two things I was hoping maybe you could clarify. I didn't really understand entirely.
Yeah.
You're saying something to this effect that if you're in a situation where you're facing difficulties, like severe difficulties in some way or another,
yeah.
You kept saying something like this: if you have any piety, then you'll look elsewhere. It wasn't clear to me what you meant, because my impression is most people, when they undergo a lot of suffering, will look elsewhere anyway, in a general sense. They'll try to find their happiness in a situation aside from that, whether it's daydreaming or whether it's drunkenness or whether it's some other ambition. Moving away from a painful situation just tends to be a fairly common aspect of human nature. So I think you meant something deeper than that.
I think deeper than that. Go ahead.
So, and also, I didn't understand exactly what you meant by if someone has any piety. That was my first question.
Has what?
Piety, like what you meant by that. Like if you have piety, then you will do this searching. It wasn't entirely clear to me what you meant by if you have piety. And secondly, I thought people would normally turn away. So I thought you meant something deeper.
Well, sukriti means that you do good and you get a good reaction from it. And one sukriti is you've cultivated knowledge, and the result of that is you take shelter in understanding. Another is bhakti sukriti, you serve God, and you have devotion, you have faith, and as a result, you take shelter. You have faith. So let's say if it's bhakti sukriti, what is one's faith in devotion? One's faith in devotion, well, one of the symptoms is that God is the maintainer. That's the angi, that's the body. And the anga, the limbs of that, the other symptoms of that kind of faith, is one of them is that God is the protector. And that means God will do what's best. So if you have that conception, that experience within you that God is the maintainer, by acting in devotion and experiencing that in this life in the past, then even though you're externalized, and when things go bad, you know, you'll be reminded of that. You'll have the faith that God is the ultimate shelter. I'll take shelter of God, and that in taking shelter of God, then happiness is guaranteed. Sublimity is guaranteed. Shelter is guaranteed. What is shelter? Shelter means protection, but the greatest protection is the protection of your value, your meaning, your happiness. So one has some past activities in that, then there's a store of that to draw on. Even today, there was something that I had to do where it was going to be a difficult thing. I had to face something. You know, and I just saw just the nature of that circumstance, you know, made me very pensive, made me prayerful to God, made me remember what I do have in terms of devotion and have that faith. And I like to do that sometimes in kirtan, whenever I have a problem, a difficulty, which means the world is not moving the way I want the world to move. I chant in the mood of Sharanagati, the six symptoms of surrender, which is basically faith that one gets. Sukriti, bhakti sukriti, faith in devotion. What is faith in devotion means? That serving God is good, serving God is the best thing. And the faith is that, you know, that I should do things favorable because that's the best thing. I should do things unfavorable. I should embrace humility as God's servant. That's a good thing. And God will maintain me. God will protect me. And you have a certain status. So I think that's the kind of sukriti, not just let me seek it elsewhere, because you're actually seeking in the same thing. You know, oh, life is bad. Let me drink. It's just another concept of let me be the enjoyer. And I guess Jnana Sukriti is also there, too, that someone has served teachers, has read scriptures, has served the traditions of knowledge. Then when they're in difficulty, they can abstract themselves and understand it in a very higher way based on the soul.
Okay. So in other words, by piety, you mean like a background of good impressions directed toward higher things, whether it's through bhakti or knowledge, and that's what one relies on in these circumstances. One naturally has this kind of momentum, hopefully, to take shelter of these deeper enduring values and enduring truths when one undergoes some kind of difficulty, right? Basically.
Yes, and if you don't have them, then what do you take shelter in? Wurijan Prabhu, who's one of our great mentors, he always says, you should take tests in your anxiety. What do you take shelter of? Do you eat? Do you sit down and watch a movie? You know, you go to sleep? Does one take intoxication? I mean, do you get, you know, what do you take shelter in? When things are really difficult, what do you take shelter in? And that's a test of your bhakti. Mm. And to the extent that you have that sukriti, that store, then you rely on truth for happiness.
Well, and would you also say, though, Maharaj, it may just be that you may not have this great background of good karma or piety or something, but that sometimes those kind of adverse circumstances may put you in the kind of reflective state that may just open up the desire to explore other avenues. I mean, in other words,
wow, I got this.
You might say,
yeah.
Sorry, did you hear me, or should I repeat myself? Is it okay?
Right, I know, I heard you.
So in other words, while it may be more natural for someone who has a background of kind of good deeds and things like that, or whatever, however you want to put it, to take shelter of these more abiding truths when they're undergoing hardship, is it unreasonable to think that, well, it may be that someone doesn't have that, but these circumstances can sometimes be a springboard for life adjustments. Like, they could be a kind of nodes in one's life that allow one maybe to undergo transformations where otherwise one might have just been swept along the waves of their kind of conditioning.
Yeah, well, I would say that someone has to start somewhere, you know? So obviously the world is working for everyone. I mean, if you have a theistic conception, sees everyone as God's servant. So everyone is God's son. So God is working for the benefit not just of the devotees, but the non-devotees, or people who are more advanced or less advanced. But the more sukriti you have, the more faith you'll have to take shelter of God. And you can see in a person's life what his faith is. You know, how much does one actually sacrifice for God and the divine? How much does one actually follow principles of life? Faith is not just I believe or I don't believe. Faith is a conviction based on experience. So it's faith is the experience of what? Bhakti. Bhakti is good. How good is bhakti? Bhakti's so good, I'll give up everything that's out of value to my attainment of the lotus feet of God, the lotus feet of Krishna. How good do you consider bhakti? And we can see in our life, it's all faith. It's all faith. What are we taking shelter of? And if we do so many things that are diversions, from the internet to whatever we do, to overeating, to revenge in circumstances, to whatever it is, it's a reflection of faith. So it is a faith, the sukriti. I can say our faith is our store of conception, our store of experience that serving God is good. So one will take shelter in that way.
Well, I have one more question, Marsh.
Okay.
I didn't feel, maybe this isn't the right way to put it. I didn't feel entirely satisfied about your answer to the question about whether one can suffer when doing one's dharma. And not that I thought, I mean, it made sense to me, but it seemed to me that there was a lot of other aspects to this. So if I understand correctly, the question was, last discussion you said that suffering is is often an indication that we're not in the right place. But and particularly, you know, there's often examples from health, like if you're not living the right kind of lifestyle, then health problems, you know, the symptoms may be a way of indicating you have to change your behavior. But then there's this more kind of deeper spiritual, psychological kind of way of saying, it may, you know, your desires may not be in line with dharma, with the right way to be, and therefore suffering could kind of shock you or make you reflexive enough to change your behavior in a deeper sense. And so the question was, well, can't sometimes performance of your duty bring suffering? And your answer, if I understood it properly, was it can, because it's not only a matter of doing what's right, but we have to become the kinds of people that we value doing what's right. And we get joy and satisfaction from doing what's right. So that in that interim phase, we may be doing our dharma, but it may not be a source of happiness or joy. Is that correct? Did I understand your answer?
Yeah, that's what I said, but I wouldn't mind going deeper on this.
Well, first of all, I want to say I shouldn't have said I wasn't satisfied. I think it's a good answer. It reminds me of, although I think there's some things we can explore more fully, but it reminds me of people like, I'm a big fan of Aristotle's ethics, the Nicomachean ethics, and there the central theme in his notion of ethics is virtue, and by virtue he means dispositions to aim at the right kind of things. The other way of crossing it out that I won't get into now, but things like to become a courageous person, to become a wise person, a prudent person, a temperate person, all that kind of stuff.
His ethics is one's character, not necessarily one's behavior.
Well, in other words, behavior is important, but as far as he's concerned, and again, my understanding, I'm not an Aristotelian scholar, but is that you focus on character, and behavior should generally be a byproduct. But of course, right. To understand what good character is, we have to get a sense of what kind of acts are good and bad. But yeah, he's not like some modern theorists who the goal of their ethical theory is to kind of have a calculating device by which we can say this act is bad or this act is good. He's much more concerned with character.
Right.
So anyway, he makes the point that you don't have virtue unless you do one of you, there's three things you have to do to have virtue.
This is good. This is good stuff. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you like it. Let me know if we're going too far afield. I won't be offended.
No, you're not. You're not going far enough.
He said to do to attain full, complete virtue, you have to do the right thing. You have to be doing it for the right reason, and you have to be happy doing it. So the idea is that it's not just a matter of being a good or bad person. There's a kind of middle phase where you're moving towards being a fully virtuous person, but you really haven't attained complete virtue because your kind of conditioning is still at odds with what is right. You're just a strong enough person that you overcome your conditioning. But the higher level of virtue is by repeated practice, hard work, and particularly by choosing to do the right thing when the circumstances arise repeatedly, you conquer over the kind of unhealthy conditioning, and you become the kind of person who does the right thing, and it flows from these core dispositions. You do it for the right reason, and you take satisfaction doing it. So he makes a point about happiness that, you know, he said virtue is totally intertwined with happiness and distress, because often we don't do the right thing because of happiness and distress, but on a deeper level, our happiness becomes a kind of indication that we've attained virtue if we're happy for the right reasons. So anyway, I wanted to say I appreciated your point, because from that kind of perspective, and also Confucius, who's a lot like Aristotle, although he's in China, he also made the point that, you know, after many years of practice, you can follow your tastes and you'll do the right thing. But that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of hard work. He said it took him till he was like 60 or something. but anyway, I wanted to say that I appreciated your answer, and I wanted to cite some of the great authorities in my life, at least. But here's where I felt like I thought we could go further into it. You know, sometimes I think we have this view in the yoga traditions that if you do the right thing, you're always going to be blissed out or something, and you're going to somehow become numb to the pain of the world. And I confess, Marge, maybe I don't have the right view, or maybe we disagree on this, but that doesn't seem right to me. If we look at the lives of great saints, it's not like they had a general anesthesia by which they experienced life. And so I can't help but think, why can't it be that someone, when doing their duty, may undergo hardship? And they may love doing their duty, but the hardship may just be because the world is the way the world is. And yeah, there might be some unhappy, there might be some pain or something. Now, it's not a deep existential pain, but it's still pain. I'm asking, why couldn't that be the case? Am I wrong? I mean, is it the fact that yogis actually don't really experience hardships or something? Or, I don't know. We're using suffering now in a special way, where suffering kind of doesn't include, there could be pains that aren't suffering or something.
Yeah, I would say, I would make a dichotomy between pain and suffering. You know, I'm trying to find something to read. I'll find it in a second. But I would make the dichotomy between pain and suffering. Yeah. I'm trying to do two things at once. I can't think. There's definitely a distinction between, I guess maybe it's just words or not just words, but obviously, it's kind of like this. Bhagavad Gita says, Asochananda Sochas Twam Pragyavadam Javasate Gatasu Nagatasu Nanu Panditi Sochita. While speaking learned words, Arjuna, you're a fool, because the wise lament neither for the living nor the dead, right? Now, does that mean that they're not compassionate? No. What it means is this is just another point. They're lamenting not that they're changing bodies, not that they're dying, that's inevitable. They're lamenting for their ignorance. They're lamenting for the person's ignorance.
It's a little bit of a different point, like you said. But is there something related to that?
It's a little bit different, but what the point I was going to make is that, this paradukha dukhi, in our tradition, right? One has no suffering, but he suffers for others. He's suffering for the other person's lack of dharma, So that's like a saintly person, but it's not in other words, yes, that suffering is not a reflection of anything in disharmony for the person, but rather that type of suffering for the person is a reflection of his harmony, that he's actually not for himself, but for others, that he's full of love, and therefore he identifies with others. And therefore there's a certain type of suffering. But obviously, it's a different type of quality. We wouldn't expect, that type of person to fall in. It's not kind of like a depression. It's not on that level, a meaninglessness, a hopelessness. It's something else. So I guess, we can qualify maybe and analyze that there are different types of suffering, but it's somehow or other something different, isn't it? What would you say is the difference? Because no matter how much people suffer and someone sees suffering, I don't think, it's going to make that person depressed, But definitely there's something that they're experiencing.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes.
Not only that, but that makes sense. So in other words, they can undergo pain or discomfort or sadness because you'd think that someone who's a kind of great yogi would be more sensitive in the sense that they don't have all the distortion we have that make us callous to others. So that, Maharaj, it's really, there's a lot of stuff on the phone. I don't know, maybe it's mine, but...
it's yours.
Okay? Yeah. Okay. So what I was going to say is, I have the idea that a great yogi or someone who at least generally has committed to dharma and has achieved success in a life of dharma, they'll be the kind of person we would hope or expect would be more sensitive to other suffering, and so other suffering would move them, right? They don't become more callous. So in that sense, right, they're affected in a way by pain. But you're suggesting now that that's different from maybe them being in a self-centered way, like that the goal of their life is maximizing their own pleasure, minimizing their pain. Like those kind of considerations shouldn't move them anymore, right? Is that an okay way to maybe rephrase what you're...
It's obviously it's like apples and oranges, because there's a certain suffering of the spirit, and then I guess there's a certain suffering of... Their spirit is not suffering.
Okay, so that might be...
Their spirit should be doing. They're actually in harmony with their spirit, because their spirit is part of God and meant for service to them and others. So I don't think it's a suffering of spirit. I don't know what you call it.
But I don't know.
Go ahead.
No, please.
No, I'm
sorry. I've heard people make distinctions between pain and suffering. I think even you maybe in the past, I don't know, maybe this would be inappropriate to make that distinction. They could feel pain, but suffering tends to mean a kind of deeper, you know, a much deeper kind of affection or something.
Well,
I don't know.
That's why the Sanskrit word is better. It's Vishad Yoga. It's the suffering of dejection. It doesn't say it's the suffering of pain. Right?
You mean the yoga?
Pain,
the yoga of dejection.
Pain would be like taptam. You know, taptam would be pain, heat. You know, it's
okay.
Not that type of suffering. It's not dejection. It's not of spirit. So maybe we can refine, you know, the point that when there's disharmony, there'll be a suffering of spirit, you know.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen when you're doing the right thing, even feeling for others.
Yeah. Maybe one other.
Okay.
Do you feel okay?
No, go ahead.
Maybe one other thing that came to mind is that, you know, like think of, for example, Jesus, right? Jesus was crucified and performed, we would say, performing his dharma. And
right.
I know sometimes Indian, like modern Indian religious figures will say things about Jesus, like he didn't feel pain or anything, but except for maybe some offshoots, but generally Christians say, no, he suffered like hell. I mean, he suffered pain. That's why it was meaningful. It wasn't a joke. You know, it wasn't just some kind of false thing that he did for preaching or something. And so why couldn't we see this as an example where there is a way in which you can undergo pain, and it's not even just for others, just that the world is such that it may be that when doing your dharma, there's some pain. But even in this case, where it's just directed toward you, it still doesn't have to degenerate to that kind of despair, that kind of, you know, that you were describing. You see what I mean? Like, why not see that there may be pains which aren't just lamenting others' suffering? They may be based on yourself and your conditions. And yet, if you're doing your dharma, it should not degenerate into this kind of more existential kind of malaise or something. Would you disagree with that?
Yeah, it would kind of be like a yes and no, but I have to think about it. And maybe the next class I could discuss that. But the no is because technically speaking, at least in yoga, right?
Sorry, say it again. Say it again.
And on the platform of yoga, in the school of yoga, right?
Yeah.
There would be a point where there was no pain.
But what kind of yoga? Again, if this is the Yoga Sutra, I don't know if I think that was the best way to see this.
I'm talking about the school of yoga sutras.
Ah, well, that's a problem. Yeah. Maybe there's a distinction.
Yeah, but I actually, you know, also, let me give an example. I was in Vrindavan. I like the distinction between suffering and pain. And therefore, pain becomes quite relativized. You know, if it's not a connection with spirit, it becomes quite relativized, the experience. And even your attachment to the body, that's another thing. The more absorption one's in the body, the more one feels things, too. So definitely we would say that according to one's elevation of consciousness, even the experience of pain would be less, wouldn't it?
It might be less, but again, I don't know if it means that they live a life of kind of numbness. I agree with you. You know, maybe great yogis. I mean, we have examples of yogis who underwent surgery without anesthesia and didn't seem to flinch. I mean, I know there's examples like that. But
okay, I think this is just enough to think about. Somehow or other, I think I'm pretty happy today we had a fruitful discussion. Hopefully, one thing could lead to the next. What I do want to discuss next with the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna and Krishna as a teacher and student, and kind of like a little analysis of what's a good teacher and what's a student in terms of Arjuna. Does anybody else have any questions? Thanks, Mooney. That was great.
Okay, Marsh, talk later then.
Yeah. Would anyone else like to say hello? Be nice to hear, see who's out there.
Jeff Myers, it's Richard Fisher.
Okay. Bethany, can you mail me the numbers?
Jeff Myers.
Can you do that to me now?
No, I don't get the numbers sent to me right away. I'll get them probably tonight.
Is there any way you can kind of click in with your code and find them?
Yeah, I'm gonna let me see. I'm gonna have to hang up. I'll do that.
Okay, do that. Okay, anybody else like to say hello? Okay. And we'll end today. A bunch of hope that we'll be a sacrifice.